Hi, I'm Emily Sexton from Next Wave. So, on Wednesday, the 27th of June, Australian politics exploded, and it was impossible not to be enthralled by the drama. Kevin Rudd's ascension over Julia Gillard after 3 years brought up all sorts of responses: disappointment, promise, entertainment, apathy, and maybe even anger. So, to start today's podcast, we found a piece from UK writer Chris Thorpe of Unlimited Theatre. This was originally created for Lucy Ellison's one-minute manifestos at the Battersea Arts Centre in London.
Don't waste your minutes in reason. This is a minute. Nobody was ever persuaded anything in a minute. Use the hours for reasoned argument. Use the minutes for anger. It's okay. It's okay for your response to be, fuck this, fuck that shit, fuck it, just fuck it. Because some things are wrong. So let the luxury of a minute mean that you're an absolutist. Let the luxury of an hour mean the attempt to understand the construction of a reasoned argument. Let the luxury of a day, a week, a month be the craft of your art or your point of view, or sometimes, wonderfully, a synthesis of the two. But the luxury of a minute is, fuck this. Fuck you, this is wrong. Fuck you, this is the wrong path. Fuck you for suggesting idealism is adolescent. Fuck you for treating the market like a human being. Fuck you for encouraging resentment of the unlucky. Fuck you for equating anger with shame and naivety. Fuck you for smiling indulgently when you're told you're hated. Fuck you for giving a man the opportunity to smear his shit into the nation's culture like he smeared his shit into its TV. Fuck you for making no sacrifices whilst preaching pointless sacrifice. Fuck you for not asking, how can we make everyone healthy, but why should we? And fuck you, I'll take this minute for myself, thanks. And I'll offer you no solutions. Solutions are for hours and days and weeks and months. And those will come. But this is a minute. Fuck you.
Hey, you know what?
That was read by Dave Sleswick. So, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Breakfast Club is a program designed to ignite big opinions, good discussion, and personal stories. Our theme for Wednesday, the 3rd of July, was The Politicians Have Lost Us: Art, Apathy, and Hope. What you're about to hear was recorded live at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne, Australia. And our speakers today are Brianna McNish, Georgie Mattingly, and Ben Eltham. Now, my first speaker is Georgie. She graduated from the Victorian College of the Arts with a Bachelor of Arts Honours in 2012. She's one of our Kickstart artists who is creating work for the 2014 festival. She often adopts a playful humour and a quirky use of visual aesthetic. In doing this, she aims to beautify confronting spaces or events as a tool to question people's limits and values. She has practised her art in both Melbourne and in Mumbai in India.
Last Wednesday, when all the shabam went down, I really got into the Facebook posts that were happening. One of my favourite posts was one of Kevin Rudd sticking his finger in his ear and eating his own earwax. It went viral on the internet, and this vulgar gesture really got me thinking, not so much about the politics itself, but about our various forms of cultural entertainments that can give us a sense of relief from hopelessness in these tense situations. I would say that this is what I'm ultimately focusing on in my own artistic practice, about the human spirit and our need for hope in tense and ethically strenuous situations. To give you a brief rundown on some of my background so you know where I'm coming from, I've excreted brightly coloured fluoro shit. I've worked with animals in an anaesthetised state and visited beauty parlours with street beggars from slums in India. And it's funny because when I begin to sum up my entire creative practice into this series of projects, I think, wow, what an absolutely ridiculous and useless set of projects. Can you imagine the politicians meeting over breakfast right now and thinking to themselves, shit, half-dead animals, the artists have lost us. When we talk about art, apathy and hope in a political sense, I think it really boils down to a question around the actual power that art has to make an impact and if so, what that impact should be. Hope for me is something about change, about making the world a better place, or at least a promise thereof. And apathy would then just be about art that doesn't attempt to amend or change anything. Two of my favourite artists, Santiago Sierra and Paul Yor, they actually work through this sense of apathy. Santiago Sierra often highlights the social and ethical inequalities of hiring labourers for measly amounts of money to perform useless tasks for him. He's paid men to masturbate for him. He's paid prostitutes to have a line tattooed across their back. He's paid a series of black and white males and females to have anal sex with each other in various combinations. And some of you might even remember when he came down to Melbourne last year and burnt his giant letter K. All of his works are really dismal and quite void of any sense of hope. However, I think what's key for me is that they provoke a vital ethical inquiry into public awareness. So Paul Yor's most recent exhibition, Everything is Fucked, was like his own personal and artistic statement of literally giving up on the world. He built this immense and overbearing installation with erect penises, swear words, smiley faces and rainbows. Of course it's ridiculous. There's even a pointlessness to even looking at the work and contemplating its artistic content. It even made me feel really disappointed in the human race for even making all this stuff. It's really gross. And what's even grosser is that this work was censored and taken down by the local council. But at least this action made way for a hearty public debate. So the point I'm trying to get at here is that we can't really determine what art is actually going to do, because there's no two people the same in the world. What is hopeful for one person might be absolutely dreadful for the next. And in saying that, people might not even see the work. It might be so boring to them that they might not give a shit. It may as well be totally invisible. So why would we keep making it? Because if we don't, we're lying lifeless and apathetic in our beds. So for better or for worse, or for even nothing at all, we need to keep making our art. And even Kevin Rudd, the supposed leader of this country, has tasted his own earwax in a public forum for no productive reason at all, but mere self-fulfilling and even somewhat perverse pleasures. So why can't we?
Our second speaker is Brianna McNish. She's a theatre maker based in Melbourne. Recently, she has been developing new Australian writing, created immersive performances, and designed participatory installations. In 2012, she directed Tuesday by Loris van der Geer for MKA Theatre, The Hide by Maddie Young for the Melbourne Fringe Festival, and she currently serves on the National Steering Committee for Young People in the Arts Australia.
So let's just think about commercial theatre for a moment to begin with. I'm using commercial theatre for this example because while it's far from my area of expertise, I think it most clearly illustrates the point I'm trying to make. I think the point also applies to differing extents to the work that myself and my peers are making in the independent theatre scene. I've come up with a quick list, a non-exhaustive list, of aspirations for theatre. We're thinking like King Kong here. This kind of theatre wants you to be on the edge of your seat. It needs to be full of twists and turns. It should be entertaining. It should engage with the fact that it is live and happening right in front of you in real time. It should also get a reaction out of you. Theatre is renowned for its diva personalities, its public tantrums, and the backstabbing. It's reliant on the media for success in the form of ticket sales and its capacity for general appeal. You can probably see where I'm going with this. Last week's leadership spill had people on the edge of their seats. The lead-up was full of twists and turns, and it was entertaining. It got a reaction out of me and every other person with a sarcastic quip to share on Facebook. When I asked my friends what their thoughts were, the most common response was something along the lines of, well, it was really exciting watching it all unfold. If you and I are watching a leadership spill, and we're talking about how impressed we are at Julia Gillard's ability to hold back the tears, rather than what the moment means politically, then I reckon we're watching theatre, not politics. So my question for myself today is, when politics has become theatre, what have we got left to put on our stages? Part of my personal answer to this lies in the work that I've been creating for Next Wave that I'd like to speak a little bit about now. My project is about older people. A few years ago, my grandparents, becoming increasingly frail, moved into a nursing home. My grandfather had fought it every step of the way. To begin with, he didn't want to use a walking stick, then he didn't want to use a walker, he didn't want to be pushed around in a wheelchair, and he didn't want to be institutionalised. My family never had the opportunity to talk about my grandfather moving away, and perhaps more importantly and more significantly, we never talked about it with him. We never discussed what it meant to leave his wife of 50 years, to leave his home. As I've begun work on this project, I have found out just how unexceptional my grandfather's story is. The project I'm working on for Next Wave looks at reframing this moment of moving away from your home and into a care environment as an older Australian as significant, as worthy of interrogation and passionate discussion by us as individuals and by society more broadly. As I've interviewed more and more older people for this project, I've begun to understand in a more complex way the political implications of my work. One woman in particular really highlighted this for me by explaining to me how she sees my work. During the interview, we got chatting about what the project would look like, and I rambled on for a while about formal innovation in theatre, site-specific this and that, and she stopped me and she said, "Ultimately, what you are building is a picture of what people's homes mean to them. And I wonder if what you were doing can be instrumental in encouraging the aged care ministry to do more about providing help. Your work itself is good from an artistic point of view, but from a political point of view and from the point of view of the people you are interviewing, you could do so much more with it." This woman's hope and clarity was intimidating and inspiring. I can only speak for myself right now in this moment. I don't want to speak for anybody else in the room today, but I want to make theatre, I want to make art that is an antidote to the rule of spectacle that dominates so much of our public life today. I don't want to traffic in entertainment, in shock and awe tactics that leave audiences stunned and silenced. I don't want to talk mass appeal or the visibility of my brand as an artist, and I don't want to keep people on the edge of their seats. The Parliament is apparently better at that than I will ever be. I want change of a particular kind. Not the kind of change that begins with anger and grand public speeches and the burning of buildings, but the kind of change that begins with one person taking the time to imagine the world differently, better. Right now, I want the art that I make to provide a space and a place for empathy, for connection with the life of another person. I want to provide a moment in time for people to engage in the type of thinking, imagining, dreaming, and feeling that can lead to change. My provocation for everybody this morning is: political change comes from a place of empathy, imagining, and thoughtfulness. Can art be this place?
Our final speaker is Ben Eltham. He's a writer, journalist, researcher, and creative producer from Melbourne. He is currently a fellow at the Centre for Policy Development and a research fellow at Deakin University's Centre for Memory, Imagination, and Invention.
Today I wanted to talk about three books. Two of them are about hope and one of them is about love, actually. I work as a political journalist. One of the things that I've been doing over the last few days has been fairly carefully examining what's going on in our society and our democracy at the very highest levels of power. And on one level, it's highly discouraging because, like a lot of people in our society, I was really rather disappointed in the way that our politicians have been behaving really over the last 3 years. And I think that there's some real democratic issues for us as a society to address in the way that we are changing the head of our government without a democratic vote. Beyond that, I think there's some really interesting things that we all have to think about as citizens about the way in which our society can move forward from what has been a fairly disappointing and certainly, I'd even say a vicious and quite nasty period of politics. For someone who follows it closely, it's sort of, being closer to it, you actually see more of the nastiness and more of the viciousness, unfortunately. And more of the personal cost that it takes on people's lives. And I'm not talking simply about the lives of politicians, many of whose families break up during their time in politics, but also on the effect that political decisions have on ordinary people, whether they be people coming to our country looking for a better life or whether they be sole parents who have to support a family on welfare benefits. The three books I want to talk about are these. One is a book by James Vanatakis, who's a professor at the University of Western Sydney. It's called The Cultural Commons of Hope. The second is a book by Jonathan Sacks, who is the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom, and it's called The Politics of Hope. And the third is a book by an Oxford historian called Theodore Zeldin, called An Intimate History of Humanity. And I'm just going to give you a little potted summary of the three of them by way of moving to my question. James Vanatakis is one of my academic collaborators. His book is about the idea of a cultural commons. Now, some of us might understand what a commons is. In the olden days, particularly in Britain, the idea of a commons was a part of the land. It might have been a forest or a meadow, which was commonly owned, so that ordinary peasants or ordinary people could graze their cattle or cut wood from that particular part of the land. Now, of course, one of the things that happened during the Industrial Revolution was that many of these commons were enclosed. They were, in effect, sold off to capitalists. And that was one of the things that helped catalyse the Industrial Revolution, which has given us, amongst other things, the tremendous material wealth which we enjoy today. The idea of a cultural commons is an idea of something that's not materially owned commonly, but spiritually or culturally owned commonly. James, in his book, was talking about the cultural commons of one particular idea of hope. And he was pointing out that hope as a very powerful idea, because not only is it held in common amongst everyone in society, amongst all of humanity, but it's a profoundly positive idea which can help to catalyse movements for social change and a better way of interacting and a better way of going about our lives, of building a better society. Jonathan Sacks's book, The Politics of Hope, is about 15 years old now. Sacks was a philosopher at Cambridge before he became a rabbi, and he has a very sophisticated understanding of liberalism and libertarianism, which he says are the two key ideas which have shaped our modern world. What he says those ideas have led to is a cult of the individual, of the individual's rights rather than the collective responsibility. Sacks is really interested in interrogating that idea and in encouraging all of us to think about how we have responsibilities to each other rather than rights of our own that we need to protect. His idea about the politics of hope is about building on something that is bigger than the individual, that is broader than simply the narrow and often quite nasty and petty debate that dominates our politics. The final book I wanted to talk about is Theodore Zeldin's An Intimate History of Humanity. Zeldin was a historian, or is a historian. His book is a really interesting examination of the role of the emotions in human history. Zeldin has a very high regard for the arts because he believes that the arts, unlike many of the other instruments of human power and of human symbol-making, are able to catalyse human interaction. He's a lover of the theatre because he believes that every actor enters into the role when they play a role, they enter into the skin, the mind, the emotions of another human being. And he sees that as a window to a way for ordinary people to better understand each other across societies and across cultures. Similarly, he sees the role for art as opening up new conceptual and symbolic and visual windows to talk to other people and to understand other societies, to build those connections. My question is, how can we connect better to each other? What are our responsibilities to each other?
And seeing as this is the last in the winter series for Breakfast Club, it's a really good question. How are we going to maintain these kinds of conversations face to face? outside of Next Wave's platforms? How do you live change in an everyday way? Which brings us to our overtime session. We asked some of our speakers to report back on some of the ideas that were shared at their tables.
Some people at my table brought up a really good point, and they were saying how they believed that there was a kind of response, social responsibility held by both politicians and artists, because as much as there can be a collective experience in society, our spokespeople are artists on a cultural level, but also like politicians on a political level. They speak for us, they're our leaders, so they represent us. And there's a kind of feeling of outcry if what they say or what they represent doesn't fit right with us.
Often in your practice, Georgie, you've been a bit of a provocateur. How does that sit against the idea of being more like a mirror, something that reflects or you know, is a voice for larger society opinions and ideas?
Yeah, you're making a provocation, not far from what we were asked to do today at Next Wave. You make, you know, not necessarily a statement, but you propose a really complex question, not in words, but through visuals or performance or however you do it. And my favourite audience is an active audience that actually talks and rebuts, or I think that's what really ignites a good artwork. I never really thought of it as me making a statement on behalf of anyone. Mm-hmm. I thought I was, you know, activating someone's ethical conscience.
Mm. Bree, do you see yourself as speaking on behalf of people?
It's really interesting because a while back I kind of had, I think, and all artists go through this, or they should go through this crisis of faith of like, why me? Why do I get to tell stories? Why is my voice valid? And particularly as like a, you know, a white middle-class Australian, like what makes my not particularly oppressed voice like relevant and interesting? And I kind of got stuck in this like deep black pit of wondering about why me, until one day I was like, actually, perhaps I'm asking myself the wrong question. Rather than why do I, and this is going back to stuff that we talked about today, as an individual have a right, actually, if I have taken this privilege upon myself, I have a responsibility. I do see myself, I think, as like speaking for or with people who don't have a voice in another way. I don't really see myself as the kind of provocateur that Georgie is, I don't think.
Have you had that discussion with some of the elderly people that you've been been interviewing, where you've asked them how do you feel about me being the one that tells your story?
No, I haven't. Maybe I should, though.
I guess the point of you being there is that you're asking them questions, not... You
know, yeah, it's a very particular relationship, actually. Like, when you're in a room and you're interviewing people, it's a very, like, delicate relationship that you're building as an interviewer and an interviewee. And I don't always think that, like, complex, like, political or social discussion makes for good personal and intimate stories, which is what I think my project is looking for to succeed.
What other kind of observations were there about that collectivity versus individual kind of role?
We had a fairly in-depth conversation about the nature of our democracy, I guess, about whether parties were the things that we voted for, whether it was leaders that we voted for.
Finishing up, we kind of said, you know, look, that's the end of Breakfast Club, but not the end of discussion. Keep meeting over coffee, having conversation, keep posting great stuff on Facebook, a kind of democratic form of expression. Just keep it flowing.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Bree?
Yeah, we had a similar kind of sentiment among our table. I think someone mentioned something about the... it was me. I mentioned that, like, maybe I'll just stop having shit conversations with my friends. Like, maybe I'll just stop bitching about people and talking about, like, guys. Perhaps perhaps I need to have the kind of conversations that we had this morning every day. They're great. They're interesting. They're in-depth and they're meaningful.
You don't need someone else to tell you to have them.
No, I shouldn't.
Ben, what did you kind of conclude from the morning?
I think there's a real need in our society for this face-to-face, this interpersonal, present, like real person conversations, because a lot of our conversations are mediated. So they're on Facebook or they're on Twitter or they're via the mass media. And I think there's a really big difference, isn't there, in the sort of conversations you can have in a face-to-face environment. So, yeah.
Do you find... Sometimes when I think I'm looking at someone, because it isn't mediated and I can't go back and edit, I have to be more accountable for every single word that I say. You know, so you have to really think before you open your mouth sometimes, especially in this context where you're often talking to strangers, people you don't know. Whereas on Twitter or on, you know, any kind of other, you know, you don't really know who's reading it, so you can kind of just say it without as much consequence, perhaps, or not.
I think there's a level of courtesy that is sort of inherent in the interpersonal conversation that's in real life that doesn't exist online. And one of the big problems of our political conversation is the kind of level of abuse that we've descended to because people can have these anonymous conversations and are kind of hiding behind their screen, so to speak. And I think that's been one of the reasons why the current parliament's been so vicious and so
it's been like
nasty.
A mirror. It's been like a mirror for what occurs online, do you think? Or
I think that the increasing prevalence of online political conversations has spilled over into the nastiness of the current political debate.
So that is the last of our podcast for this series of Breakfast Club. We will definitely be running more events, so your best way to find out about that is to visit the Next Wave website and make sure that you are signed up to our pegboard. The Next Wave website is nextwave.org.au. And our pegboard goes out every second Thursday and is chock full of ideas, opportunities and content for people who love art. Personally, I reckon it's the best newsletter in the country. Thank you to the Wheeler Centre for hosting us for the last 4 weeks. My name's Emily Sexton. We'll see you next time.